Oxford Criminology, where we love him. Ben used to work here, for those of you who haven't met him before. He is now Professor of Global City Policing at UCL in the Jill Dando Institute. And today he's going to be talking to us about public trust and police legitimacy.
Thanks, Mary. Thanks very much for inviting me back. It's a pleasure to be here. I've actually got this written down, so I'm going to read it out, but you can't see that, can you, if I sit right in the middle? That's right, I'll stand up. Before I start, there's two little provisos I thought I would mention. I'm going to spend a lot of time today talking about the experiences of immigrants in the UK, actually in Europe as well. And when we're sitting in contexts like this, because of the amazing work that Mary and Border Criminologists have done, we tend to think about immigrants in a very particular way. Those are not the immigrants I'm talking about today. I'm talking about the great mass of immigrants who don't have those kinds of experiences. So actually, some of the things I'll be talking about might lead into some of those experiences, but they're yet to happen to the people I'm talking about, put it like that. And the other thing is a useful proviso at the beginning is I'm going to say lots of things about group X thinks Y. On each and every single occasion, what I actually mean is on average, people from group X are more likely to think Y than Z. But I can't say that every time I say people from group X. So that's what I mean, because this is all based on statistics. So it's all about probabilities of having a particular view or whatever it is. Okay, so they're my two provisos. So what I wanted to talk about today, as Mary said, is this trust and legitimacy in the context of policing in the UK and much more widely as well. So the questions I'm interested in today are things like, why do people trust the police or not? What does legitimacy mean in this context and where can we find it? What role does our place and community and society play in generating or undermining both trust and legitimacy? How do the ways in which people experience not just policing, but also their wider social, cultural and economic environment, the location of police and policed within structures of power, authority and effect, shape judgments of this foundational state institution? And what does all this mean for policing in a global city like London, which is some of the stuff I'll get onto later on? These are important questions. I probably don't need to say a lot of this, but you know, it's my introduction, so I'm going to. These are important questions for three interrelated sets of reasons. First, there's a large amount of evidence, some of which I'll discuss later, linking trust and legitimacy to cooperation, deference, and compliance. People who invest trust in and grant legitimacy to the police are more likely to report crimes and suspicious activities, more likely to defer to officers at moments of need, and probably more likely to comply with the law. Without trust and legitimacy, the job of the police, as we envision it in the UK, would essentially be impossible. Second, the presence or absence of trust and legitimacy in a particular person or within a specific group or community is often intimately linked to feelings of belonging, status and dignity, or conversely, exclusion, denigration and humiliation. The processes which build and sustain public support for the police are bound up with inter and intra-group relations. How people see themselves as individuals and group members in relation to the police and the groups the police represent is a key part of this story. And we will see later, police activity can be an important factor shaping subjective and objective forms of social, economic, and cultural inclusion or exclusion. Third, the police do not exist in glorious isolation, but are rather part of and experienced by the policed, by us, as part of a much wider set of interlinked state and social institutions. The criminal justice system, most obviously, but also more ephemeral systems of social ordering and control. What we think about police can influence what we think about state and society. And what we think about the condition of society and the performance of government can shape what we think about police. Now that's a pretty big set of claims, but as the title of the lecture suggests, I've always moved on from it, I want to contextualise the discussion in a very particular way, the diversity of London and of course the UK as a whole. I think that doing so can help us ground these claims in a specific context and hence understand them better. The essential question is what this diversity can tell us about how trust and legitimacy are generated and reproduced, and what can happen when they are undermined or lost. Ethnic, religious and social diversity are of course often numbered among the challenges facing police in the 21st century. Alongside cybercrime, terrorism and austerity, the increase in diversity brought about by immigration and globalisation certainly does raise a number of issues for police in a global city like London. And by the way, the global city thing is a way that the police in London like to refer to themselves, because policing global cities comes with a unique set of challenges. It's unlike policing anywhere else, which is not true, of course. I've lost my place now. Certainly does a number of issues for police in a global city such as London. There are practical concerns, such as the challenge of tracking offenders moving into and out of the UK. The difficulties for police tasked with responding to the alleged distinction, between legal and illegal migrants. And at a more mundane level, the question of how largely monolingual police organisations can serve profoundly polylingual populations. But my motivation for organising this discussion around the question of diversity, and particularly immigration, relate to an arguably deeper set of concerns. The idea that diversity undermines the social cohesion and shared norms upon which the criminal justice system relies. Norms concerning, for example, the desirability of cooperating with the police. While my primary concern is with issues of trust, legitimacy and identity, that is, along the way I want to tackle what is, to my mind at least, the widespread view that immigrants and diversity are inevitably problems for both the police and the wider activity of policing. Activity oriented towards the reproduction of normative social order. Indeed, the equally widespread view that immigrants themselves almost inevitably experience problematic relationships with the police. These viewpoints find many and varied expression in our social and public discourse. The extremes of the far right and Islamophobia, certainly, but also elements of left liberal thinking that stress the allegedly negative effects of mass immigration on group and value-based forms of solidarity. David Goodhart, I'm looking at you. On this latter account, the diversity engendered by immigration poses significant risks to social solidarity, our shared sense of responsibility, and our collective will to address social problems. I think such ideas are premised on a correct understanding of a process, but not outcome. People's relations with police are embedded in norms and values. Not only are trust and legitimacy founded, most importantly, on judgments about the way the police should behave, norms that might be expected to vary significantly across cultures, but trust and particularly legitimacy can themselves be seen as normative. We grant the police legitimacy in part because we've been brought up to do so and because others around us do the same. As a result, we feel a certain social pressure to follow suit, hence normative pressure. Legitimacy is, in these terms, exactly the sort of social norm that value diversity is thought to undermine. But as I will show, this is not actually what transpires. In fact, it's almost the reverse of what we can find in data drawn from a wide variety of sources. The association between immigration, diversity and social cohesion is obviously a hugely contentious area of debate, and not one in which I wish to stray too far, although we can get into that later if you want. But I think we can use immigration and the experience of immigrants as tools for understanding what trust and legitimacy are, the way they are formed and reproduced, and what happens when they are lost, as I said earlier. And perhaps we can address some of these other concerns too along the way. Discussion will proceed from here as followed, my introduction being out of the way. After outlining what I mean by trust and legitimacy and what we know about the factors underpinning them, we'll move on to explore what immigration and increasing diversity might mean for the relationship between police and public. Drawing on empirical data collected from London and elsewhere, I will present evidence that demonstrates there is nothing inevitably problematic in the relationship between police and immigrant communities. And indeed, the immigration might actually be a positive influence on trust and legitimacy. Two factors are central to explaining this, or so I will claim, so I'm going to tell you my results. First, what people want from the police is remarkably similar across multiple social and political contexts. Fairness, engagement with their community, and a baseline level of effectiveness and efficiency. To the extent that police demonstrate these behaviours, positive relations with communities of all types should be forthcoming. Second, because they represent social order and indeed society, people's relations with the police are conditioned by their wider views and experiences, such as, for example, the change in perspective brought about by moving from a country with a corrupt and inefficient criminal justice system to one where corruption is relatively low and the police and courts relatively effectively managed. The experience of many immigrants, of course. Turn on virus protection. The final part of the lecture will shift from immigrants, the language of immigrants, to the language of minorities. Here the story changes. There can be little doubt that the relationship between police and some minority communities is problematic, and often deeply so. In particular, people from some minority communities, often not composed of recent immigrants, but rather those of a long-standing presence in the UK, do not perceive police as fair and engaged, or indeed effective. This undermines their connections not only with police, but also with society as a whole, further accelerating processes of distancing and tension. I will close by considering the implications of all this, in terms of the onus it places on the police to manage these relationships better, in terms of recognising the wider structural forces in play, and then hence the limits of what police on their own can reasonably be expected to achieve. So the first question is, what are trust and legitimacy? These are words used liberally in connection with the police, along with confidence, which I'll treat as synonymous with trust for our purposes today. Like many such terms, though, many such social science terms, their meaning is fuzzy, contested, and often ill-defined. It's therefore worth spending a little time, I think, defining what I mean by these words for the rest of the conversation. Turning first to trust, recent academic work seems to be coalescing around the idea that trust is a willingness to be vulnerable to another, that it's founded in beliefs one has concerning their current and likely future behaviours. We can say that an individual trusts a person or institution when they willingly place valued outcomes, for example their security or their freedom, in the hands of that act or institution on the basis of a belief that they or it have the right intentions and are competent to perform relevant duties or actions. To elaborate slightly, as Honora O'Neill and many others have argued, what we might think as competency or efficacy as a core component of trustworthiness, people attend as much or more to honesty, openness, respect, reliability, and interestingly, in the current context, an ability to show vulnerability, by which I think she may mean, and I think other people certainly do mean, a willingness to show a basic shared human condition with the person you are asking to trust you, something that the police aren't very good at. We might therefore say that trust in the police is premised on beliefs that officers and institution are effective in the task set them, are well-intentioned and will continue to be so in the future, and crystallised in a willing acceptance of the police role in securing outcomes such as security itself, safety, justice and freedom. Seen in these terms, trust is based in part on direct and indirect experiences of the behaviour of police officers. These are important moments in which the beliefs that constitute trust are formed. It is also based on generalised motivations to trust that individuals may or may not have. In particular, people will be motivated to trust when they feel they share group membership with the police, when they have a sense that they and the police are in some way on the same side. And when police are located within appropriate value-bearing narratives, stories or social or cultural stories about the values officers and institution enact, represent and embody. Finally, as Anthony Giddens and others have argued, trust in institutions always, in the final analysis, involves a leap of faith. People cannot truly know that police are effective and well-intentioned, but many are willing to indicate that they believe these things to be true and behave in a commensurate manner. Legitimacy is in many ways a partner concept to trust, not least in as much as it too is fuzzy, contested and often ill-defined. However, I can draw work here on work I've been doing with John Jackson, Mike Huff and a number of others over recent years to provide what is, I hope, becoming a fairly widely accepted definition, at least within bits of academic criminology. It's important to note this is an empirical concept of legitimacy. We are concerned with the judgments people make of the police and the reasons for those judgments. We are not concerned, for today at least, with the appropriateness of the rules that govern police work and the extent to which police adhere to these rules, which would define a normative account of legitimacy. At the most fundamental level, this empirical legitimacy concerns both the justification of power, do we believe that those who govern us have the right to do so, and obedience, do we believe that those who govern us have the right to command us. Scholars concerned with police and other criminal justice institutions typically identify three constituent components, drawing on the work of David Beef and others, of legitimacy, three separate components of legitimacy judgments that map closely to this general schema. The first is normative appropriateness. Searchman defines legitimacy as, and I quote, a perception or assumption that the actions of an entity are desirable, proper, or appropriate within some socially constructed systems of norms, values, beliefs, and definitions. On this account, legitimacy is premised on a fundamental accord between rulers and ruled that's founded in shared norms and values, and it's established via what Alison Liebling has termed the moral performance of power. Applied to the police, this process involves the implicit and explicit claims that police officers make, to be representatives of a morally appropriate institution. People judge officer behaviour against specific norms of conduct, a view of how the police should behave, generating a sense of normative alignment with police, or not, depending on the judgment they reach. And they draw lessons from such judgments about how they themselves should behave in relation to the police and others. The second component of legitimacy is usually considered to be legality. People ask themselves whether police are following the rules intended to govern their behaviour. I'll leave this to one side for today, not least because I think we're increasingly of the opinion that this component of legitimacy is in fact subsumed into normative appropriateness. The third component of legitimacy is an internalised sense of consent to authority structures. Do we believe we have a duty to obey the instructions of, in this case, police officers? Duty to obey, seen in these terms, echoes Weber's insight that power is transformed into authority when it's seen to be legitimate. When one recognises the authority of the police, one feels a normatively grounded obligation to obey officers' instructions and the rules operative within the space governed by the police. Implicit here is the idea that institutional normativity grants the right to dictate appropriate behaviour in certain prescribed circumstances, the former providing a basis for the latter. Now, trust and legitimacy are plainly related to one another, but how? Well, trust represents people's positive expectations and evaluations regarding police intentions and capabilities. Legitimacy is the property or quality of possessing rightful power, and the subsequent acceptance of and willing deference to authority. One possibility is to consider trust as evaluations and expectations regarding normatively appropriate behaviour. So I've already kind of said that. Hardin states, and I quote, "To say that we trust you means we believe you have the right intentions towards us and that you are competent to do what we trust you to do," which are, of course, normative judgments. They relate to a particular understanding of how the police should behave. Legitimacy emerged when subordinates, that's us, deem that power holders tend to act in normatively appropriate ways. So, when the former trusts the latter. There is an important sense, therefore, in which trust flows into or forms a precondition of legitimacy. Empirically, this amounts to saying that though there was one, there is very often, although not always, the other. Trust and legitimacy are therefore embedded in a set of norms and values concerning intentions, abilities, and moral appropriateness. What norms and which values, though? Research conducted within the procedural justice paradigm tends to suggest that the most salient issue is fairness. People believe, for example, that officers should make decisions in an objective and neutral fashion, treat people with dignity and respect, and be open and honest in their decision-making processes. And they make judgments about the moral rectitude of the police largely on the basis of such behaviours. Acting in a procedurally just manner indicates that the police have the right intentions, that they have in mind the interests of those they serve, that they are trustworthy, and that they operate according to an appropriate moral framework. Procedural injustice, of course, communicates precisely the opposite. Naturally, other norms and values are likely to be at stake in people's judgments of police. These include, but are not limited to, effectiveness. An ineffective, inefficient police force seems unlikely to live up to normative expectations about how the police should behave. The idea that the actions of authorities should be restrained within certain limits, that the police should respect the boundaries of their rightful authority, and a wider set of concerns about the nature of order society and the types of behaviours needed to assert it. This latter point opens up the possibility, indeed the inevitability, that many other factors contribute to trust and legitimacy, from people's psychological preferences, the need for order and hierarchy, for example, to their social, cultural and economic position within a particular context. We'll come on to some of these issues shortly. Finally, the idea that legitimacy is closely related to identity and shared group membership is a consistent theme in research in this area. On some accounts, the moral performance of power is central to convincing the public that the police share group membership with them, or are valid partners within an intergroup relationship. Feeling that one has a legitimate relationship with police serves to persuade that this is an appropriate authority to deal with crime, disorder, misfortune and or disaster, even in a particular situation or in some more general sense. Other accounts treat some level of shared group membership as a given, and stress the extent to which shared social identities mediate the link between fairness judgments, trust and legitimacy. The idea here is that police represent social identities that are salient to many people and within which they recognise the figure of the police officer as an important group representative, something that chimes very well with sociological research and accounts that position police as representative of nation, state and community. This makes people highly attuned to the identity-relevant aspects of officer behaviour, to their ability to say, in essence, you belong or you do not belong. The experience of procedurally just policing strengthens the bonds between individual and group. It generates and encourages and or enhances a sense of inclusion and value within this group and promotes identification with the authority figure concerned and with the values it represents, and hence legitimacy, cooperation and compliance. Now, the role of social identity in procedural justice provides one important reason why the trust and legitimacy judgments of immigrants might be different to those of non-immigrants in a wide variety of possible ways. For example, and to put it bluntly, if some immigrants, particularly the recently arrived, are unclear about their status in relation to social categories defined by national identity and citizenship, then the fairness of police activity may be less salient in their judgments. In particular, if one does not feel one yet belongs, perhaps that one will never belong, the behaviour of police officers may be less identity relevant and therefore a less important predictor of trust and or legitimacy. On the other hand, it might be that police activity, especially personal contact with officers, could be more salient among immigrants precisely because they are uncertain about their status in their new home and about the nature of their relationship with its institutions. Status uncertainty may make one more attuned to the identity relevant messages encoded in police activity. There are, of course, other reasons why the views of immigrants and the ways they think they've come to form these views may differ from those of non-immigrants. I'll address just one here today, the question of what immigrants bring with them from their country of origin. In particular, the change in institutional frameworks people experience upon migration may shape their views of police. When moving to a new country, they may view the state institutions of their new home as equivalent, the same as, those in their country of origin. Alternatively, their view of the institutions in their destination country may be predicted by the quality of those institutions in comparison to equivalent institutions they lived with prior to migrating. In other words, people who move from countries, and I've already said, people who move from countries with corrupt, inefficient justice systems may continue to view the justice systems in their new home as corrupt, inefficient because they've been socialised to do so, or they may compare the institutions of their new home favourably with those they have experienced before. So the lens that people use to view police, in particular, may also relate to the wider ability of the state to protect and properly serve its citizens. And because they're not merely part of the state apparatus, but also represent it in embodied form, police legitimacy may be particularly likely to be influenced by wider perceptions of state performance and the general condition of society. This idea chimes with other research on the predictors of public opinions of policing. Perceptions of the general level of corruption in the country, for example, have been linked to views of the police, as have perceptions of government performance. On a more local or visceral level, local neighbourhood conditions, the extent of low-level disorder, the strength of community cohesion, are strong predictors of trust and legitimacy. When local order seems well-established and strong, the police, representatives of that order, gain public trust and legitimacy. A key point here, I think, has been made by John Kleinig much better than I could say it, and I quote, "Police officers are not handmaidens of justice or order in vacuum. They are members of a particular social and political community and agents of state power. And to some extent, the legitimacy of their activities will be a function of the legitimacy of the larger structures and groupings of which they are part." There is much to suggest, then, that the views of immigrants and non-immigrants will differ, although the likely direction and extent of this difference is unclear. Indeed, one might conclude from the discussion so far the claim here is essentially that the views of immigrants must be different because they're immigrants, but we're not entirely clear why we think that might be the case. What then do the data say? For reasons of brevity, I'll draw on three particular surveys, actually four surveys. They each address different aspects of the discussion thus far. The first three will be looking at the relationship between trust and immigration in the Crime Survey of England and Wales, the effect of changing frames of reference on legitimacy judgments of immigrants in the European Social Survey, and a survey from London conducted by the Met that explored the views of young people from minority ethnic groups. Another disclaimer here, as is aware of things, much of this data is a few years old. So the extent I think I'm talking about the basic functioning of social groups, marked by imbalances of power and authority, the process I will describe should be independent of short to medium-term political change. However, Brexit and the so-called hostile environment for migrants are developments we might expect to alter, certainly in the long term, some of the basic functions and particularly their outcomes. We'll return to this discussion in the conclusion, and I have got some more up-to-date data from another survey later. So the first question is trust in immigration in the Crime Survey of England and Wales. CSEW is our best national source on public attitudes towards the police, or at least it was until they took out loads of the really interesting questions. And it used to contain a set of questions that combined to produce an excellent measure of trust, with a particular emphasis on measures of fairness and good intentions. So there are questions such as, the police would treat you with respect if you had contact with them. But also efficacy, such as the police can be relied upon to deal with minor crimes. Survey also records whether a respondent is an immigrant and when they first moved to the UK. This chart, if you can see it, shows the correlation between immigration status and trust. What we find is that trust in the police was on average higher among immigrants to the UK than among the UK-born population. So these people here are people who have been in the country less than 5 years. These are people who have been in the country over 40 years. And these are people who were born in the UK. On average, immigrants have higher levels of trust, and you have this kind of slightly odd curvy linear effect, which I'll come back to. Some of this difference was due to a lack of experience, particularly bad experience, of the police among the recently arrived immigrants. Overall, immigrants are less likely to have contact with the police than non-immigrants, one reason being that they commit less crime. Perhaps more personally, only 6% of those arrived in the UK in the last 5 years reported having ever been annoyed with the police, as an indicator of annoyance with the police, and probably lots of other stuff as well, compared with 14% of immigrants who arrived more than 30 years ago and 26% of people born in the UK. Once this contact experience was taken into account, the difference between immigrants and non-immigrants shrank, but there was a persistent positive association between immigrant status and trust among those who had migrated as adults that was not explained away by other variables. By contrast, those who had arrived as children had essentially the same views, on average, as their UK-born counterparts. This curvilinear association between years since first arrival and trust, which again persisted once other variables were taken into account, is, I think, really interesting. Why immigrants who have been in the UK for 21 to 40 years, these people here, less trusting of police than those who arrived before or after? One tempting suggestion, these are people who arrived in the UK in the 1970s and 1980s. A particularly difficult time for British policing, that's something of an understatement. The era of the Brixton riots, and many other riots besides, the miners' strike, the Hillsborough Stadium disaster, and many other policing scandals. We can only speculate, of course, but it may be that people arrived into a climate where the relationship between police and public was particularly strained, carried forward their first perceptions formed at this time. In other words, there's a legitimacy, there's a history to legitimacy which we need to consider. It's also worth noting that this effect is largely independent of ethnicity. This chart shows the interaction between ethnicity, very broadly measured, and immigrant status as predictors of trust. The basic pattern we saw in the previous slide is repeated. So what's going on here? I think the overall picture is of Gooden's leap of faith. Immigrants seem more inclined than others to indicate a belief that police have right intentions and are competent in the roles assigned to them. Of course, they, like everyone else, cannot know for sure whether these things are true. But I think the key point here is that believing that they are, making the leap of faith to trust, is socially useful to the individuals concerned, particularly perhaps those who have moved to a new country. Gooden's position trusts as a characteristic of individuals that enables them to bracket out the complexity of the modern world and experience it as understandable, coherent, and manageable. Placing trust in police, specifically, reassures, or may reassure, and may enable action because it motivates a sense that help and support can be invoked if needed. And as David Smith has argued, we're motivated to make the leap of faith to trust since, again I quote, we want to believe that we live in a society where most people trust the police, because a society in which most people trust the police will be far more secure than any other. What might motivate immigrants to make this leap of faith, or I should say, be more likely to make this leap of faith than others? One possibility is that British policing has a strong brand image with an arguably worldwide reach. This image, wrapped up with Scotland Yard, the Bobby on the Beat, If You're My Mother-in-Law, Midsummer Murders, and notions of fairness and equity, may provide people who have been recently moved to the UK with a heuristic on which to base their trust judgments. It's easier to make a leap of faith if one thinks, one believes, one already knows something about the object of trust. What, though, of the effect of immigration on the already resident population? After all, a key argument of the straw man I set up earlier might be that immigration damages trust in the police among the native-born population, because it undermines social cohesion and collective efficacy, which much research has shown are key predictors of such trust. And it's certainly the case that when people experience their neighbourhood or community as cohesive, as containing trustworthy people, as efficacious in maintaining order, the police, almost inevitably linked to processes of formal and informal social control, appear effective and well-intentioned. Now, this question is, statistically speaking, really difficult to answer because of the highly complicated social processes behind it. In other words, people moving into and out of areas and the reasons why they're moving out into and out of those areas, what happens to the population that's left, etc., etc. It's a dynamic process that we're trying to capture with snapshot data. But we can glean some evidence from the crime survey. Respondents in the survey can be grouped at a variety of levels of geographical aggregation, one of the smallest of which is the romantically entitled Lower Super Output Area. This is a census-based unit with a population of between 1 and 3,000 people. And because of the 2011 census, we know exactly how many immigrants were living in each LSOA in the data set. So this figure shows the interaction between the respondent's own status as an immigrant or not and the proportion of immigrants living in their area, as predictors of trust in the police. Net of a range of individual and area-level control variables, we find that among both immigrant and non-immigrant groups, trust in the police is higher in areas with greater proportions of non-UK-born residents. Levels of trust diminish as a portion of UK-born residents increases. In other words, even among the UK-born population, trust in the police is higher, on average, in areas where there are more immigrants. I would stress that this finding is indicative rather than conclusive, but it does again suggest that what seems to be a common sense view about the effect of immigration on trust can often be wrong. Moving on to the question of immigrants' frames of residence, a reference, our data here come from the Pan-European European Social Survey. Fifth over this survey in 2010-11 included a set of questions on trust, legitimacy and related constructs, on whether a respondent was an immigrant, and crucially, the country they emigrated from. The data set used here has a sample size of over 52,000 people. There are nearly 5,000 first-year immigration immigrants in that sample. They lived in 27 European countries, and they hail from a total of 166 countries of origin. This allows us to explore how the change in institutional context that occurs with the act of migration might shape immigrants' legitimacy judgments in the destination country. What we find is that people who moved from more corrupt countries where the rule of law was weaker to less corrupt countries where the rule of law was stronger, at least according to the World Bank measures of these things, tended to feel more normatively aligned with the police. So, for example, they were more likely to agree with questions such as the police generally have the same sense of right and wrong as I do. Those who had moved from poorer to richer countries, in terms of GDP per capita, felt more normatively aligned with police and a stronger sense of duty to obey. So they were more likely to agree to questions that it was their duty to do what the police tell you, even if you don't understand or agree with the reasons. It seems on this basis that immigrants do not tend to import negative views of state institutions formed in their countries of origin, but are more likely to react positively to a new, better institutional framework in their country of destination. And across Europe, of course, immigrants tend to move from poorer, more corrupt countries with weaker institutions to richer, less corrupt countries with stronger institutions. On this admittedly limited basis, one might argue that immigration is on average a positive for police legitimacy. But the main point, perhaps, is to underline the diversity and sheer breadth of the factors that can and do shape the legitimacy of the police. So, immigrants, at least in the UK, therefore seem more inclined to trust the police, and any concerns that negative views inculcated in countries of origin are imported into destination countries seem misplaced, at least in some overall sense. What were the role of identity in all this? If questions of group membership and identification are threaded through trust and legitimacy, does this play out differently depending on who you are and where you came from? The Met conducted a survey in 2010 that allows us to explore some of these questions. It sampled the 1,000 and a few more young ethnic minority men in four, inverted comma, inner London boroughs and asked them a range of questions about their experiences of police and policing. Using this data, we can trace the links between procedural justice, identity and legitimacy, and explore how these vary between those who indicated they were British citizens and those who indicated they were not, which of course not the same as immigrant, non-immigrant, but it's close enough for today. This figure summarises the analysis. Note the final variable here is cooperation, so we're moving on to what procedural justice or legitimacy do in terms of people's relations with police. What we find is this. This is slightly complicated, so I hope I'll get it right. First, for both the UK and non-UK citizens, procedural justice was very strongly associated with legitimacy. Second, for both the UK and non-UK citizens, procedural justice was associated with a feeling of identification with their area, London, and the UK as a whole, so belonging, perhaps. And this association was stronger for the non-UK group. Third, in the UK group, the path from procedural justice runs through legitimacy to a cooperation, i.e. people who are UK citizens were more likely to cooperate with the police when they granted legitimacy. Fourth, and by contrast, in the non-UK group, the path from procedural justice to cooperation runs through identity. People in this group were more likely to cooperate with police when they felt they belonged. What does all this mean? One important idea here is that what the police do, the procedural justice of their activity, is associated with people's sense of belonging. And this association is stronger for people who are not UK citizens. Fair policing, we might conclude, can encourage people to feel they belong, and of course, vice versa. Equally important, though, is that for both groups, procedural justice was a strong predictor of legitimacy and cooperation, even if the precise path through the model varied. This fits well with a wider body of research on procedural justice, which finds that almost wherever you look, you can find a procedural justice effect. The norms and values most consistently important to people when thinking about police, which underpin their legitimacy judgments, and in this case their readiness to cooperate with police, are across multiple contexts, groups and social relationships, those of fairness, of dignity, consistency, respect, openness, engagement, inclusion and voice. The weight of the evidence is therefore that A, immigrants do not have inevitably problematic relations with the police, and B, they tend to think about policing in ways that are very similar to non-immigrants. It is important not to overinterpret this. There's much we don't know. I've been talking at a relatively, arguably, very high level of abstraction. But at the very least, we have no reason to suggest that immigrants have different, more negative views of the police because they are immigrants, because they come from countries with different value sets, want different things from the police, and so on. Now, that's not the story we're used to hearing, quite frankly. And one of the reasons for this, I think, becomes clear when we switch from the language of immigrant to that of minority. While there's a need for caution here, in our language, which is one reason why I'm reading this out, is that unlike the category of immigrant, the category of minority is very diffuse. But there can be no doubt that some ethnic and other minority communities do have problematic relations with police. The most obvious example being London, being large sections of the black population. To the extent that ethnic and religious minorities are immigrant communities, and in the UK, of course, many are not, this raises the immediate question of why. If immigrants' baseline views of the police are at least no different from, and may even be more positive than, those of non-immigrants, why do some minorities have such difficult relations with the police? One answer lies, of course, in the intersection of immigrant status and race. Few would claim that the experience of London workers from Italy and Spain are the same as those from their colleagues from Nigeria or Ghana. And this opens up a set of issues that, again, speak directly to questions of trust, legitimacy and identity. On the one hand, the history of police-minority relations in London, and indeed the UK as a whole, tell us that contacts at all levels between police and members of those communities are of central importance in marking the shift, if you like, from immigrant to minority. Immigrant groups may have entered the UK with relatively positive views of the police, but in the past they have been sorely let down in interactions with officers that did not meet their expectations and which worse proved unfair, aggressive, violent, and thus labelling, denigrating and exclusionary. While things have, of course, improved, we often forget that, but they have improved, in recent years, these types of encounters are still all too common. And we can pick up their effects in the Met's Public Attitudes Survey. And this is also bringing us right up to date. This is data from 2015-16. This figure shows variation in overall trust and confidence, proportion of people thinking their local police do an excellent or good job between the white British group, which is the red line, and some of the key minority groups living in the capital. While some minority groups have less favourable opinions of the police, notably and fairly obviously black Caribbean and mixed black and white groups, others have more favourable opinions, these guys up here. This figure shows what happens if we include only those born in the UK, in other words, non-immigrants. Here, every minority group has less positive views than the white British group. Mm-hmm. In other words, when it comes to trust in the police, the presence of immigrants within many ethnic minority communities seems to act something as a protective factor, if you like. Take them out of the equation and relationships with the police and minority groups suddenly look quite a bit worse. Accumulated negative experiences within minority communities at individual and group levels is, of course, a highly plausible explanation for this really quite striking pattern. Just toggle back between those. I find that amazing. Anyway, we need to be careful here. The group level differences represented in the chart are large. For example, 67% of UK-born white British people said their local police did an excellent or good job, but just 42% of their black Caribbean counterparts felt the same way. But I do not think this is entirely the fault of the police. As we saw in the case of changing institutional frames among immigrants, a much wider set of social, cultural and economic factors come together to shape people's views and understandings of police and policing. Ron White argues that police-minority relationships are influenced not only by contact with police officers, but also by the extent to which minority groups are incorporated into wider society. The manner and extent to which a particular group is incorporated, or socially included, if you like, will have important implications for relations with police, not least, of course, because the police represent the dominant social order and reflect back to people their status and value within it. This implies that the objective characteristics of social groups and their location within cultural, political, and economic hierarchies shape views of the police. Group position will influence how group members conceive of institutions of social and political ordering. People will feel an affinity with institutions that serve their interests. Members of groups that do well out of current arrangements will tend to support the agencies tasked with maintaining those arrangements. People from socially excluded or marginalised groups, on the other hand, will have less positive views. The legitimacy of the police may suffer when people feel that the system doesn't work for them and may even be working against them. This can be seen very clearly in the ESS and many other data sets beside. Across Europe, the unemployed, those struggling financially, those living in deprived neighbourhoods, those disengaged from political activity, those who experience discrimination in and from wider society, all tend to trust the police less and grant less legitimacy, independent of their experiences of policing. And of course, many immigrants, and particularly minority group members, find themselves in exactly these types of social, cultural, and economic positions. Now, this is not, of course, to let the police and the wider criminal justice system off the hook. What they do or fail to do continues to be important, despite the wider structural forces in play. I think Benjamin Justice and Tracy Meir's work on the curricula of criminal justice provides an insightful way of framing some of what I've been saying this afternoon. Starting from the assumption that the criminal justice system is a central way through which the state communicates with its members, they say citizens, which I think is a slightly problematic word in this context, but I'm going to start saying citizen because that's the language they use. The criminal justice system is a central way through which the state communicates with its citizens and indeed seeks to educate them in what it means to be a citizen. Justice and Meir draw on the educational theory to suggest that this process has both overt and hidden aspects. They focus in particular on what they call the core of the educational process, the curriculum. The curriculum, or curricula, of criminal justice, they argue, can be found in the interactions people have with criminal justice agencies and the processes through which they move into and within criminal justice institutions. As they note, the word curriculum comes from the Latin for race course, something you move on towards a destination. These curricula constitute ways through which people learn about the values and meaning of citizenship and their status as inside or outside the social and administrative categories concerned. The overt curriculum is concerned with values of legality, participation, service to others, and engagement with society and community. Values, that is, of procedural justice, trustworthy, legitimacy, and equality of worth. It can be found encoded in the formal procedures, processes, rules, and laws which govern the activity of criminal justice institutions and actors, and in particularly, probably, the wider set of social and cultural images and ideas that surrounds the institution of, in our case, the police. The hidden curriculum, by contrast, can be found not in official rules and procedures, nor in the mainstream image of British policing, but in backstage areas and in real-life interactions between police officers and individuals. It is encoded in those mundane quotidian practices of police that are premised on unstated rather than explicit norms, rules and beliefs, in policing as it occurs on the streets, not in the books. Now, Justice and Meir stress that on many occasions the two curricula operate in tandem and reinforce one another in the message they transmit to citizens. The actual activity of many police officers can and does follow explicit rules in the ideology of policing, communicating justice, trustworthiness, inclusion, and the legitimate use of power. Yet all too often, the hidden curriculum of policing constitutes the inversion of the overt. In particular, through procedural injustice, it can undermine values of trust, legitimacy, inclusion, providing an education in what Justice and Meir's call anti-citizenship. The hidden curriculum socialises those receiving it in quite different ways to those intended by the overt curriculum. So while both curricula are in operation at the same time, and we're all exposed to them to some degree, I do not think it's too much of a stretch to claim that many first-generation immigrants respond more to the overt than to the hidden. As I mentioned, despite commonplace assumptions, they have lower levels of personal contact with the police, in part because they commit less crime. So in a basic sense, they are less exposed to the hidden curricula. And inasmuch as they may be comparing British police favourably with other police organisations they may have experienced, the overt aspects of the curriculum may be more salient to them. They're more likely than others to respond, that is, to the public image rather than the reality of British policing. And part of the reason they trust is because they buy in to the overt curriculum and what it represents. By contrast, second generation immigrants and beyond, particularly those from visible minority groups, seem prima facie more likely to be exposed to the hidden curriculum. And through such tried and tested means as stop and search, their experiences will tend towards a negative. This has implications not only, of course, for their views of the trustworthiness and legitimacy of the police, which are undermined by a sense of injustice, but also in terms of a wider course in anti-citizenship. Through their interaction with police, too many people learn, to quote Justice and Mears, anti-democratic behaviours, manufactured failure and alienation. So to conclude, there are, I've claimed, multiple factors and forces in play when we think about trust and legitimacy in the context of policing. Some of these are performance and behaviour related, but many are not. I think the experience of immigrants again offers an important lesson. I'm pushing the boat out a bit here, but I do think this is true. My suspicion is that in some general sense, we, and I'm drawing the boundary of we very widely there, are socially and culturally predisposed to trust and legitimise the police. So one could think, for example, of the legal socialisation of children, the cultural aura that surrounds the British police, or our basic need for security in a complex and sometimes bewildering world. These factors and others point overall towards support for the police and police institutions. Trust and legitimacy, therefore, provide an already existing resource for police that can be drawn upon in all the familiar ways: cooperation, compliance, deference, and so on. Yet all too often this resource is squandered, sometimes as a result of police malpractice, but sometimes also by social and economic policies that entrench inequality and poverty, and which as a result deform and undermine people's relations, not just with police, but with the wider state and society. So to close, I'd like to outline some thoughts on policy, very, very broadly defined, which also I think can usefully summarise some of the preceding discussion and tie it back to the global city. So what are some of the challenges, what I've been saying, for the police operating in a city such as London? The first of these is quite mundane, but I think it's worth saying. Police are often tasked with meeting performance targets related to public opinion polls, and I think this is a fool errand. Such targets are often put in place. The last London Mayor's 2020 target regime, one of those 20s was in police trust and confidence by 20 percentage points on a measure. But I've provided here some small insight into the depth and breadth of factors which shape public opinion of the police. Tasking police with improving something that is affected by, to give an extreme example, global migration flows, seems unfair to say the least. Knowing what's going on, for example, through the survey of the data I just showed you, is absolutely vital, which makes these surveys a really interesting tool, but they're not tools that should be linked to performance target regimes. Second point is this: just as we need to think about the way the police are integrated with other services in organisational and operational terms, we also need to consider what people experience, that people experience policing not just as a one-off delivery of service or sanction, but as part of a larger whole. This is certainly true in terms of their personal and community history of the police. But it's also the case that at some level or other, people, many people, see police as part of the general machinery of the state. And they read across when they reach judgments and draw conclusions about the different parts of this machine and the outcomes it delivers. When thinking about trust in the police, it might also, in fact, I think it is also, worth thinking about trust in government, in councils, in schools, etc. Particularly given, of course, the extent to which these agencies are increasingly seeking to deliver services jointly, at least in theory. The third point, and despite this, is that contact between individual police officers and members of the public matters even more than is often recognised. So we might claim, for example, that the first contact with police for an immigrant person or a child is an absolutely key moment in their socialisation in the place they're learning to live in. I think there is much to be done here in relation to training of police officers, not just in procedural justice, but in terms of sensitising to the extent of the power vested in them and the sensitivity of all those with whom they interact to the extent of that power. So a particular challenge, and the fourth point, a particular challenge is how to do this. It's all very well to cite police training as some kind of panacea to solving these problems, but it seems rather hard to do in reality, and there's much more research and activity needs to go on around police training on some of these issues. Part of this is a need for much closer relationships between police and academics, and not just us telling them what they should do and not just them telling us we can't do that, but working together to try and address some of these problems. But I think also we need to think much bigger than this. I think there's a danger in placing too much emphasis on the behaviour of individual police officers, responsibilising them, if you like, when we also need to think about what police organisations are doing and the policy climates within which they operate. To give just one particularly salient example, there's a need to take a long-term view of likely downstream effects of new policies and interventions, even when the timescales seem very long for policymakers and senior police officers. Is this because policing done right can have long-term crime-reducing properties, i.e. become beyond deterrence and incapacitation, while policing gone wrong can be effectively, actively criminogenic, because, as I've claimed here, police activity can change the way people think about themselves and their place and role in society. Finally, and related, I'd like to just reiterate a long-running strand of criminological thought. I'm not saying anything novel or new here. We need to think much more about the extent to which policing is an engine of social inclusion or exclusion, and or exclusion. If, as the prevent strategy states, this is what it says, support for terrorism is associated with rejection of a cohesive, integrated, multi-faith society and a parliamentary democracy, we need to consider how everyday policing, not just specialist units and tailored strategies, is experienced by people across the social, economic and political spectrum. All police activity influences how people orient themselves towards society. And just as group position, economically, socially, culturally, seems to be an important factor shaping relations with police, then police activity can be an important factor shaping group position. Every decision made by officers can serve to symbolically or materially locate people in particular social and cultural positions, with potentially significant effects for their future behaviours. Thinking about trust and legitimacy, as we've been doing this afternoon, therefore opens up space for a much wider conversation about what policing is for and the type of things we expect and want police to achieve.